The Cave of the Ancients by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read to you by Blue Friend, November 2016. Chapter 9. The silence was profound, the air of concentration intense. At long intervals there came an almost inaudible rustle, which soon subsided again into death-like quiet. I looked about me, looking at the long lines of motionless, robed figures sitting erect on the floor. These were intent men, men concentrating on the doings of the outside world. Some, indeed, were more concerned with the doings of the world outside this one. My eyes roamed about, dwelling first on one august figure and then on another. Here was a great abbot from a far-off district. There was a lama in poor and humble dress, a man come down from the mountains. Unthinkingly, I moved one of the long, low tables so that I had more room. The silence was oppressive, a living silence, a silence that should not be with so many men here. Crash! The silence was rudely and loudly shattered. I jumped a foot off the ground in a sitting position and somehow spun around at the same time. Sprawled out at full length, still in a daze, was a library messenger with wooden-backed books still clattering around him. Coming in, heavily laden, he hadn't seen the table which I had moved. Being only 18 inches from the ground, it had effectively tripped him, and now it was on top of him. Solicitous hands gently picked up the books and dusted them off. Books are revered in Tibet. Books contain knowledge and must never be abused or mishandled. Now the thought was for the books, not for the man. I picked up the table and moved it out of the way. Wonder of wonders, no one thought that I was in any way to blame. The messenger, rubbing his head, was trying to work out what had happened. I had not been near, obviously I could not have tripped him. Shaking his head in astonishment, he turned and went out. Soon calm was restored, and the lamas went back to their reading in the library. Having been damaged top to bottom, literally, while working in the kitchens, I had been permanently banished therefrom. Now, for menial work, I had to go to the great library and dust the carvings on book covers and generally keep the place clean. Tibetan books are big and heavy. The wooden covers are intricately carved, giving a title and often a picture as well. It was heavy work, lifting the books from shelves, carrying them silently to my table, dusting them, and then returning each book to its allotted place. The librarian was very particular, carefully examining each book to see that it really was clean. There were wooden covers which housed magazines and papers from countries outside our boundaries. I liked particularly to look at these, although I could not read a single word. Many of these months-old foreign papers had pictures, and I would pore over them whenever possible. The more the librarian tried to stop me, the more I delved into these forbidden books whenever his attention was taken from me. Pictures of wheeled vehicles fascinated me. There were, of course, no wheeled vehicles in the whole of Tibet, and our prophecies indicated most clearly that with the advent of wheels into Tibet, there would be the beginning of the end. Tibet would later be invaded by an evil force which was spreading across the world like a cancerous blight. We hoped that, in spite of the prophecy, larger, more powerful nations would not be interested in our little country, which had no warlike intentions, no designs upon the living space of others. I looked at pictures and I was fascinated. On one magazine, of course I do not know what it was called, I saw some pictures, a whole series of them, which showed the magazine being printed. There were huge machines with great rollers and immense cogwheels. Men in the pictures were working like maniacs, and I thought how different it was here in Tibet. Here one worked with the pride of craftsmanship, with the pride of doing a job well. No thought of commerce entered the mind of the craftsmen of Tibet. I turned and looked at those pages again, and then I thought of how we were doing things. Down in the village of Sho, books were being printed. Skilled monk carvers were carving onto fine woods Tibetan characters, carving them with the slowness which ensured absolute accuracy, absolute fidelity to minute detail. After the carvers finished each board of print, others would take that board and polish it, so that no flaw nor roughness remained on the wood. Then the board would be taken away to be inspected by others for accuracy as to text, for no mistake was ever allowed to creep into a Tibetan book. Time did not matter. Accuracy did. With the boards all carved, all carefully polished and inspected for errors or flaws, it would pass to the monk printers. They would lay the board face up on a bench, and then ink would be rolled onto the raised, carved words. Of course, the words were all carved in reverse, so that when printed, they would appear the right way around. With the board inked and carefully inspected once again to make sure that no portion was left uninked, a sheet of stiff paper akin to the papyrus of Egypt would be quickly spread across the type with its inked surface. A smooth rolling pressure would be applied to the back of the sheet of paper, and then it would be stripped off from the printing surface in one swift movement. Monk inspectors would immediately take the page and examine it with minute care for any fault, any flaw, and if there was a flaw, the paper would not be scrapped nor burned, but would be made up into bundles. The printed word in Tibet is held as near sacred. It is considered to be an insult to learning to destroy or mutilate paper which bears words of learning or religious words. Thus, in the course of time, Tibet has accumulated bundle after bundle, bale after bale of slightly imperfect sheets. If the sheet of paper was considered satisfactorily printed, the printers were given the go-ahead, and they went on producing various sheets each one of which was as carefully examined for flaws as was the first. I often used to watch these printers at work, and in the course of my studies, I had to undertake their own work myself. I carved the printed words in reverse, I smoothed the carvings after, and under meticulous supervision, I inked and later printed books. Tibetan books are not bound as are Western books. A Tibetan book is a long affair, or perhaps it would be better to say it was a wide affair and very short, because a Tibetan line of print extends for several feet, but the page may be only a foot high. All the sheets containing the necessary pages would be carefully laid out, and in the fullness of time, there was no hurry, they would dry. When they had been allowed time and time again for drying, the books would be assembled. First, there would be a baseboard, to which there were attached two tapes. Then, upon the baseboard, would be assembled the pages of the book in their correct order. And when each book was thus assembled, upon the pile of printed pages would be placed another heavy board, which formed a cover. This heavy board would bear intricate carvings, perhaps showing scenes from the book and, of course, giving the title. The two tapes from the bottom board would now be brought up and fastened across the top board. Some considerable pressure would be exerted so that all the sheets were forced down into one compact mass. Particularly valuable books would then be carefully wrapped in silk, and the wrappings would be sealed so that only those with adequate authority could open the wrappings and disturb the peace of that so carefully printed book. It seemed to me that many of these Western pictures were of women in a remarkable state of undress. It occurred to me that these countries must be very hot countries, for how otherwise could women go about in such a scanty state? On some of the pictures, people were lying down, obviously dead, while standing over them would be perhaps a villainous-looking man with a piece of metal tubing in one hand from whence issued smoke. I never could understand the purpose of this, for, to judge from my own impressions, the people of the Western world made it their chief hobby to go around and kill each other. Then, big men with strange dresses on would come and put metal things on the hands or the wrists of the people with the smoking tube. The underclad ladies did not distress me at all, nor excite any particular interest in me, for Buddhists and Hindus, and in fact all the peoples of the East, knew well that sex was necessary in human life. It was known that sexual experience was perhaps the highest form of ecstasy which the human could experience while still in the flesh. For that reason, many of our religious paintings showed a man and a woman, usually referred to as God and Goddess, in the closest of close embraces. Because the facts of life and of birth were so well known, there is no particular need to disguise what were facts, and so sometimes detail was almost photographic. To us, this was in no way pornographic, in no way indecent, but was merely the most convenient method of indicating that, with the union of male and female, certain specific sensations were generated, and it was explained that with the union of souls, much greater pleasure could be experienced. But that, of course, would not be upon this world. From talks with traders in the city of Lhasa, in the village of Sho, and those who rested by the wayside at the western gate, I gathered the amazing information that in the Western world it was considered indecent to expose one's body to the gaze of another. I could not understand why this should be so, for the most elementary fact of life was that there had to be two sexes. I remembered a conversation with an old trader who frequented the route between Kalimpong in India and Lhasa. Throughout some considerable time, I had made it my business to meet him at the western gate and to greet him at one more successful visit to our land. Often, we would stand there and chat for quite a while. I would give him news about Lhasa, and he would give me news about the great world outside. Often, too, he would bring books and magazines for my guide, the Lama Mingyur Dondup, and I would then have the pleasant task of delivering them. This particular trader once said to me, "I have told you much about the people of the West, but I still do not understand them. One of their sayings in particular just does not make sense to me. It is this: man is made in the image of God, they say, and yet they are afraid to show their body, which they claim is made in the image of God. Does it mean, then, that they are ashamed of God's form?" He would look at me questioningly, and I, of course, was quite at a loss. I just could not answer his question. Man is made in the image of God. Therefore, if God is the ultimate in perfection, as should be the case, there should be no shame in exposing an image of God. We so-called heathens were not ashamed of our bodies. We knew that without sex there would be no continuity of the race. We knew that sex on appropriate occasions and in appropriate surroundings, of course, increased the spirituality of a man and a woman. I was also astounded when I was told that some men and women who had been married, perhaps for years, had never seen the unclad body of the other. When I was told that they made love only with the blinds down and the lights out, I recall I thought my informant was taking me for a country bumpkin who really was too foolish to know what was going on in the world. And after one such session, I decided that at the first opportunity, I would ask my guide, the Lama Mingyur Dondup, about sex in the Western world. I turned away from the Western gate and dashed across the road to the narrow, dangerous path which we boys of Chakpori used in preference to the regular path. This path would have frightened a mountaineer. Frequently it frightened us as well, but it was a point of honor not to use the other path unless we were in company with our seniors and, presumably, betters. The mode of progression upwards entailed climbing by hand up jagged tufts of rock. dangling precariously from certain exposed roots, and at all times doing these things which no presumably sane person would do if they were paid a fortune. Eventually, I reached the top and got into the Chakpori by a route which was also known to us and which would have given the proctors fits if they too had known. So, at last, I stood within the inner courtyard, far more exhausted than if I had come up the orthodox path, but at least Honor was satisfied. I had done the trip up somewhat faster than some of the boys did it down. I shook the dust and the small stones out of my robe, and I emptied my bowl, which had collected numerous small ants, and then, feeling fairly presentable, I wended my way inwards in search of my guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondop. As I rounded a corner, I saw him proceeding away from me, and so I called, "Oh, Honorable Lama!" He stopped and turned and walked towards me, an action which possibly no other man in Chakpori would have done, for he treated every man and boy as equal. As he used to say, it is not the outward form, it is not the body which one is at present wearing, but what is inside, what is controlling the body, that counts. My guide himself was a great incarnation who easily had been recognized on his return to his body. It was an always remembered lesson for me that this great man was humble and always considered the feelings of those who were not merely not so great, but some who were, to put it bluntly, downright low. "Well now, Lobsang," said my guide, "I saw you coming up that forbidden path, and if I'd been a proctor, you would now be smarting in quite a number of places. You would have been glad to remain standing for many hours." He laughed and said, "However, I used to do substantially the same thing myself, and I still get what is possibly a forbidden thrill in seeing others do what I can no longer do. Well, what is the rush, anyhow?" I looked up at him and said, "Honorable Lama, I have been hearing horrible things about the people of the Western world, and my mind is indeed in a constant turmoil, for I'm unable to tell if I'm being laughed at, if I am being made to look a worse fool than usual, or whether the marvels which have been described to me are indeed fact." "Come with me, Lobsang," said my guide. "I'm just going to my room. I was going to meditate, but let us discuss things instead. Meditation can wait." We turned and walked along, side by side, to the Lama Mingyar Dondop's room, the one which overlooked the Jewel Park. I entered the room in his footsteps, and instead of immediately sitting down, he rang for the attendant to bring us tea. Then, with me by his side, he moved across to the window and looked out across that lovely expanse of land, land which was one of the most beautiful places, perhaps in the whole world. Below us, slightly to our left, was the fertile wooded garden known as the Norbu Linga of Jewel Park. The beautiful clear water sparkled among the trees, and the inmost one's small temple, set upon an island, was gleaming in the sunlight. Someone was crossing the rocky causeway, a path across the water made of flat stones with spaces in between, so that the water could flow freely and the fish would have no bar. I looked carefully and thought I could distinguish one of the high members of the government. "Yes," Love sang, "he's going to see the inmost one," said my guide in answer to my unspoken thought. Together we watched for some time, for it was pleasant here, looking out upon that park, with beyond it the happy river sparkling and dancing as if with joy of a beautiful day. We could also see down by the ferry, one of my favorite spots, and it was a never-ending source of pleasure and amazement to me to see that ferryman get his inflated skin boat and paddle away merrily to the other side. Below us, between us and the Norbu Linga, pilgrims were making their slow way along the Lingor Road. They went along, giving hardly a glance to our own Shakpori, but keeping a constant lookout to see if possibly they could see anything of interest from the Jewel Park, for it must have been common knowledge to the ever-alert pilgrims that the inmost one would be at the Norbu Linga. I could see, too, the Kashia Linga, a little park, well wooded, which was by the side of the ferry road. There was a small road leading from the Lingor Road down to the Kichu, and it was used mainly by travelers who wanted to use the ferry. Some, however, used it to reach the Lama's Gardens, which was on the other side of the ferry road. The attendant brought in tea for us, and pleasant food as well. My guide, the Lama Mingyur Dondup, said, "Come, Lobsang, let us break our fast, for men who are going to debate must not be empty inside unless their heads so proves to be empty." He sat down on one of the hard cushions which we of Tibet use instead of chairs, for we sit upon the floor cross-legged. So seated, he motioned for me to follow his example, which I did with alacrity because the sight of food was always one to make me hurry. We ate in comparative silence. In Tibet, particularly among monks, it was not considered seemly to speak or to make a noise while food was before us. Monks alone ate in silence, but if they were in a congregation of any great number, a reader would read aloud from the sacred books. This reader would be in a high place where, in addition to seeing his book, he could look out across the gathering of monks and see immediately those who were so engrossed with their food that they had no time for his words. When there was a congregation of monks eating, then proctors would also be present to see that there was no talking except for the monk reader. But we were alone. We passed a few desultory remarks to each other, knowing that many of the old customs, such as remaining silent at meals, were good for discipline when one was in a throng, but were not necessary for just a pair such as we. So, in my conceit, classed myself as an associate of one of the truly great men of my country. "Well, Lobsang, tell me what it is that bothers you so," said my guide. "Honorable Lama," I said in some excitement. A trader passing through here, and with whom I was discussing matters of some moment at the Western Gate, gave me some remarkable information about the people of the West. He told me that they thought our religious paintings obscene. He told me some incredible things about their sex habits, and I am still not at all sure that he was not taking me for a fool. My guide looked at me and thought for a moment or two, and then he said, "To go into this matter, Lobsang, would take more than one session. We have to go to our service, and the time is near for that. Let us just discuss one aspect of this first, shall we?" I nodded very eagerly because I really was most puzzled about all this. My guide then said, "All this springs from religion. The religion of the West is different from the religion of the East. We should look into this and see what bearing it has on the subject." He arranged his robes about him more comfortably and rang for the attendant to clear the things from the table. When that had been done, he turned to me and started the discussion, which I found to be of enthralling interest. "Lobsang," he said, "we must draw a parallel between one of the religions of the West and our own Buddhist religion. You will realize from your lessons that the teaching of our Lord Gautama have been altered somewhat in the course of time. Throughout the years and the centuries which have elapsed since the passing from this earth of the Gautama and his elevation to Buddhahood, the teachings which he personally taught have changed. Some of us think they have changed for the worse. Others think the teachings have been brought into line with modern thought." He looked at me to see if I was following him with sufficient attention, to see if I understood what he was talking about. I understood, and I followed him perfectly. He nodded to me briefly, and then continued. "We had our great being, whom we call Gautama, whom some call the Buddha. The Christians also had their great being. Their great being propounded certain teachings. Legend, and in fact actual records, testify to the fact that their great being, who, according to their own scriptures, wandered abroad in the wilderness, actually visited India and Tibet in search of information, in search of knowledge, about a religion which would be suitable for Western mentalities and spiritualities. This great being came to Lhasa and actually visited our cathedral, the Jokang. The great being then returned to the West and formulated a religion which was in every way admirable and suitable for the Western people. With the passing of that great being from this earth, as our own Gautama passed, certain dissensions arose in the Christian Church. Some 60 years after that passing, a convention or meeting was held at a place called Constantinople. Certain changes were made in Christian dogma. Certain changes were made in Christian belief. Probably Some of the priests of the day felt that they had to put in a few torments in order to keep some of the more refractory of their congregation in good order. Again he looked at me to see if I was following him. Again I indicated that I was not merely following him, but that I was vastly interested. The men who attended that convention at Constantinople in the year 60 were men who were not sympathetic toward women, just as some of our monks feel faint at the mere thought of a woman. The majority of them regarded sex as something unclean, something which should only be resorted to in the case of absolute necessity, in order to increase the race. These were men who had no great sexual urges themselves. No doubt they had other urges, perhaps some of those urges were spiritual, I do not know. I only know that in the year 60, they decided that sex was unclean. Sex was the work of the devil. They decided that children were brought into the world unclean and were not fit to go to a reward until in some way they had been cleansed first. He paused a moment and then smiled as he said, I do not know what is supposed to happen to all the millions of babies born before this meeting at Constantinople. You will understand, Lobsang, that I am giving you information about Christianity as I understand it. Possibly, when you go to live amongst these people, you will have some different impression or different information, which in some way may modify my own opinions and teachings. As he finished his statements, the conches sounded and the temple trumpets blared. About us there was the ordered bustle of disciplined men getting ready for service. We too stood up and brushed off our robes before making our way down to the temple for the service. Before leaving me at the entrance, my guide said, Come to my room after Lobsang, and we will continue our discussion. So I entered into the temple and took my place among my fellows, and I said my prayers, and I thanked my own particular God that I was a Tibetan, the same as my guide, the Lama Mingyur Dondup. It was beautiful in the old temple, the air of worship, the gently drifting clouds of incense which kept us in touch with people on other planes of existence. Incense is not just a pleasant smell, not something which disinfects a temple. It's a living force, a force which is so arranged that by picking the particular type of incense, we can actually control the rate of vibration. Tonight in the temple, the incense was floating and giving a mellow, old-world atmosphere to the place. I looked out from my place among the boys of my group, looked out into the dim mists of the temple building. There was the deep chanting of the old lamas accompanied by, at times, the silver bells. Tonight we had a Japanese monk with us. He had come all the way across our land after having stopped in India for some time. He was a great man in his own country, and he had brought with him his wooden drums, drums which play such a great part in the religion of the Japanese monks. I marveled at the versatility of the Japanese monk. at the remarkable music he produced from his drums. It seemed truly amazing to me that hitting a sort of wooden box could sound so very musical. He had the wooden drum, and he had sort of clappers, each with little bells attached, and also our own lamas accompanied him with silver bells, with the great temple conch booming out in appropriate time. It seemed to me that the whole temple vibrated. The walls themselves seemed to dance and shimmer, and the mists away in the distance of the far recesses seemed to form into faces, the faces of long-dead lamas. But for once, all too soon, the service had ended, and I hurried off, as arranged, to my guide, the Lama Mingyur Dhanda. "You have not wasted much time, Lobsang," said my guide cheerfully. "I thought perhaps you would be stopping to have one of those innumerable snacks." "No, Honorable Lama, I am anxious to get some enlightenment, for I confess the subject of sex in the Western world is one which has caused me a lot of astonishment after having heard so much about it from traders and others." He laughed at me and said, "Sex causes a lot of interest everywhere. It is sex, after all, which keeps people on this earth. We will discuss it as you require it so." "Honorable Lama," I said, "you said previously that sex was the second greatest force in the world. What did you mean by that? If sex is so necessary in order to keep the world populated, why is it not the most important force?" "The greatest force in the world, Lobsang," said my guide, "is not sex. The greatest force of all is imagination. For without imagination, there would be no sexual impulse. If a male had no imagination, then the male could not be interested in the female. Without imagination, there would be no writers, no artists, there would be nothing whatsoever that was constructive or good." "But Honorable Lama," I said, "are you saying that imagination is necessary for sex? And if you are, how does imagination apply to animals?" "Imagination is possessed by animals," Lobsang, "just as it is possessed by humans. Many people think that animals are mindless creatures without any form of intelligence, without any form of reason. Yet I, who have lived a surprisingly long number of years, tell you differently." My guide looked at me, and then, shaking a finger at me, he said, "You profess to be fond of the temple cats. Are you going to tell me that they have no imagination? You always speak to the temple cats. You stop to caress them. After you've been affectionate with them, once they will wait for you a second time, and a third time, and so on. If this were mere insensitive reactions, if these were just brain patterns, then the cat would not wait for you on that second or third occasion, but would wait until the habit had been formed. No, Lobsang, any animal has imagination. An animal imagines the pleasures in being with its mate, and then the inevitable occurs." When I came to think about it, to dwell upon the subject of it, was perfectly clear to me that my guide was absolutely right. I had seen little birds, little hens, fluttering their wings in much the same way as young women flutter their eyelids. I had watched little birds and seen very real anxiety as they waited for their mates to return from the unceasing forage for food. I had seen the joy with which a loving little bird had greeted her mate upon his return. It was obvious to me, now that I thought about it, that animals really had imagination, and so I could see the sense of my guide's remarks that imagination was the greatest force on earth. One of the traders told me that the more occult a person was, the more he was opposed to sex, Honorable Lama. I said, "Is this true, or am I being teased? I have heard so many very strange things that I really do not know how I stand in the matter." The Lama Mingyar Dondup nodded sadly as he replied, "It is perfectly true, Lobsang, that many people who are intensely interested in occult matters are intensely antipathetic to sex, and for a special reason. You have been told before that the greatest occultists are not normal, that is, they have something wrong with them physically. A person may have a grave disease such as TB or cancer or anything of that nature. A person may have some nerve complaint, whatever it is. It's an illness, and that illness increases metaphysical perceptions." He frowned slightly as he continued, "Many people find that the sexual impulse is a great drive. Some people, for one reason or another, use methods of sublimating that sexual drive, and they may turn to things spiritual. Once a man or a woman is turned away from a thing, they become a deadly enemy to that thing. There's no greater reformer nor greater campaigner against the evils of drink than the reformed drunkard. In the same way, a man or a woman who has renounced sex, possibly because they could not satisfy nor be satisfied, will turn to occult matters, and all the drive which formerly went, successfully or unsuccessfully, into sexual adventures is now devoted to occult adventures. But, unfortunately, these people so often tend to be unbalanced about it. They tend to bleat that only in renouncing sex is it possible to progress. Nothing could be more fantastic. Nothing could be more distorted. Some of the greatest people are able to enjoy a normal life and also to progress vastly in metaphysics." Just at that moment, the great medical lama Chinro Nobo came in. We greeted him and he sat down with us. "I am just telling Lobsang some matters about sex and occultism," said my guide. "Ah, yes," said the Lama Chinro Nobo. "It is time he was given some information on this. I have thought so for a long time." My guide continued, "It is clear that those who use sex normally, as it is meant to be used, increase their own spiritual force. Sex is not a matter to be abused, but on the other hand, nor is it a matter to be repudiated. By bringing vibrations to a person, that person can increase spiritually. I want to point out to you, however, that the sexual act should only be indulged in by those who are in love, by those who are bound together by spiritual affinity. That which is illicit, unlawful, is merely prostitution of the body, and can harm one as much as the other can help one. In the same way, a man or a woman should have only one partner, eschewing all temptations which would lead from the one path of truth and righteousness. The Lama, Jinro Nobo, said, "But here is another matter upon which you should dwell, respected colleague, and it is this, the matter referring to birth control. I will leave you to deal with it." He rose to his feet, bowed gravely to us, and left the room. My guide waited for a moment and then said, "Are you tired of this yet, Lobsang?" "No, sir," I replied. "I'm anxious to learn all I can, for this is strange to me." "Then you should know that in the early days of life upon earth, peoples were divided into families. Throughout areas of the world, there were small families which, with the passage of time, became big families. As seems to be inevitable among humans, quarrels and dissensions occurred. Family fought against family. The victors killed the men they had vanquished and took their women into their own family. Soon it became clear that the bigger the family, which was now referred to as a tribe, the more powerful and the more secure it was from the aggressive acts of others. The tribes were increasing in size as the years and centuries went by. Some men set up as priests, but priests with a bit of political power, with an eye to the future. The priests decided that they had to have a sacred edict, what they could call a command from God, which would help the tribe as a whole. They taught that one had to be fruitful and multiply. In those days, it was a very real necessity because unless people multiplied, their tribe became weak and perhaps completely wiped out. So the priests who commanded that the people be fruitful and multiply were even safeguarding the future of their own tribe. With the passage of centuries and centuries, however, it is quite clear that the population of the world is increasing at such a pace that the world is becoming overpopulated. There are more people than food resources justify. Something will have to be done about it. I could follow all this. It made sense to me, and I was glad to see my friends of the Pargo Kaling, the traders who had traveled so far and for so long, had told me the truth. My guide continued, "Some religions, even now, think that it is wrong indeed to place any limitation upon the number of children who are born. But if one looks at world history, one sees that most of the wars are caused by lack of living space on the part of the aggressor. A country has a rapidly expanding population, and it knows that if it goes on expanding at this rate, there will not be enough food, not be enough opportunity for those of its own people. Thus they make war, saying that they have to have living space. Then, Honorable Lama, I said, how would you deal with the problem? Lobsang, he replied, the matter is easy. If men and women of goodwill get together to discuss the thing, the old forms of religions, the old religious teachings, were in every way suitable when the world was young, when people were few. But now it is inevitable, and it will be in time, that fresh approaches be made. You ask, what would I do about it? Well, I would do this. I would make birth control legal. I would teach all peoples about birth control, how it could be accomplished, what it is, and all that could be discovered about it. I would see that those people who wanted children could have perhaps one or two, while those who did not want children had the knowledge whereby children would not be born. According to our religion, Lobsang, there would be no offense in doing this. I have studied the old books dating back long ages ago, before life appeared on the western parts of the globe. For as you know, life first appeared in China and in the areas around Tibet, and spread to India before going westwards. However, we're not dealing with that. I decided then and there that as soon as I could, I would get my guide to talk more about the origin of life upon this earth, but I recollected that now I was studying all that I could on the matter of sex. My guide was watching me, and as he saw that I was again paying attention, he continued, as I was saying, the majority of wars are caused by overpopulation. It is a fact that there will be wars. There will always be wars, so long as there are vast and increasing populations. And it is necessary that there should be, for otherwise there will be absolutely overrun with people, in the same way that a dead rat is soon completely overrun by swarms of ants. When you move away from Tibet, where we have a very small population, and you go to some of the great cities of the world, you will be amazed and appalled at the vast numbers, at the vast throngs of people. You will see that my words are correct. Wars are utterly necessary to keep down the population. People have to come to Earth in order to learn things, and unless there were wars and diseases, then there would be no way whatever of keeping the population in control and keeping them fed. They'd be like a swarm of locusts eating everything in sight, contaminating everything, and in the end, they would finish themselves up completely. Honorable Lama, I said, some of the traders who have talked about this birth control thing say that so many people think that it is evil. Now why would they think that? My guide thought for a moment, probably wondering how much he should tell me, for I was yet still young, and then he said, birth control to some appears to be murder of a person unborn, but in our faith, Lobsang, the spirit has not yet entered the unborn baby. In our faith, no murder can possibly have occurred. And anyhow, it is, of course, manifestly absurd to say that there is any murder in taking precautions to prevent conception. It is just as well to say that we murder a whole lot of plants if we prevent their seeds from germinating. Humans too often imagine that they are the most wonderful thing that ever happened in this great universe. Actually, of course, humans are just one form of life, and not the highest form of life at that. However, there is no time to go into such matters as that for the present. I thought of another thing which I had heard, and it seemed to be such a shocking, such a terrible thing, that I could hardly bring myself to speak of it. However, I did. Honorable Lama, I have heard that some animals, cows for instance, are made pregnant by unnatural means. Is that correct? My guide looked quite shocked for a moment. Then he said, "Yes, Lobsang, that is absolutely correct. There are certain peoples in the Western world who try to raise cattle by what they call artificial insemination. That is, the cows are inseminated by a man with a great big syringe instead of having a bull do the necessary work. These people do not seem to realize that in making a baby, whether it be a baby human, a baby bear, or a baby cow, there is more than just the mechanical mating. If one is going to have good stock, there must be love or a form of affection in the mating process. If humans were artificially inseminated, then it could be that, being born without love, they would be subhumans. I repeat to you, love, saying that for the better type of human or beast, it is necessary that the parents shall be fond of each other, that they shall be raised in spiritual as well as physical vibration. Artificial insemination carried out in cold, loveless conditions results in very poor stock indeed. I believe that artificial insemination is one of the major crimes upon this earth. I sat there with the evening shadows stealing across the room, bathing the Lama Mingyar Dandap in the growing dusk. And as the dusk increased, I saw his aura flaring with the great gold of spirituality. To me, clairvoyantly, the light was bright indeed, and interpenetrated the dusk itself. My clairvoyant perceptions told me, as if I did not know before, that there I was in the presence of one of the greatest men of Tibet. I felt warm inside me. I felt my whole being throb with love for this, my guide and tutor. Beneath us, the temple conscience blared again, but this time they were not calling us, but calling others. Together, we walked to the window and looked out. My guide put his hand on my shoulder as we looked out at the valley below us. The valley, now partially enveloped in the purple darkness. "Let your conscience be your guide, Lobsang," said my guide. "You will always know if a thing is right or if a thing is wrong. You are going far, farther than you can imagine, and you will have many temptations placed before you. Let your conscience be your guide. We in Tibet are a peaceful people. We are people of a small population. We are a people who live in peace, who believe in holiness, who believe in the sanctity of the Spirit. Wherever you go, whatever you endure, let your conscience be your guide. We are trying to help you with your conscience. We are trying to give you extreme telepathic power and clairvoyance so that always, in the future, for so long as you live, you can get in touch telepathically with great lamas here in the high Himalayas. Great lamas who, later, will devote the whole of their time to waiting for your messages. Waiting for my messages? I'm afraid my jaw dropped with amazement. My messages? What was there so special about me? Why should great lamas be waiting for my messages all the time? My guide laughed and slapped my shoulder. The reason for your existence, Lobsang, is that you have a very, very special task to do. In spite of all the hardships, in spite of all the suffering, you will succeed in your task. But it is manifestly unfair that you should be left on your own in an alien world, a world that will mock you and call you a liar, a fraud, and a fake. Never despair, never give up, for right will prevail. You, Lobsang, will prevail. The evening shadows turned into the darkness of night. Below us, the lights of the city were a twinkle. Above us, a new moon was peeping down at us over the edge of the mountains. The planets, vast millions of them, twinkled in the purple heavens. I looked up, thought of all the forecasts about me, all the prophecies about me, and I thought also of the trust and the confidence shown by my friend, my guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup, and I was content. End of Lesson 9.